This episode of We Are Libertarians is brought to you by Audible.com. Enjoy one free audiobook courtesy of We Are Libertarians. Choose from more than 100,000 audiobook titles, including works by Ron Paul, Walter Block, Murray Rothbard, and the Cato Institute. Audible.com also has audio of radio and TV programs and audio versions of magazines and newspapers. You can get the Audible app on any mobile device or download the audio to your computer. Go to audibletrial.com/WAL or head to WeAreLibertarians.com and find the link to get one free month of Audible today. Welcome to We Are Libertarians for this week. I am Chris Spangle. To your right is... To my right is Greg Lenz.
Hello, everyone.
And to my left is Suzanne Schaefer. Welcome back.
Thank you. Hello.
Suzanne is a blogger at anarchyandacupofcoffee.tumblr.com. Also, what's your Twitter?
Anarchy and Coffee.
Okay.
I tried to get that in however many characters they let you.
So check that out, and thanks for being with us this week. Creighton, Joe, Gina, they're missing in action.
They're slackers.
I know.
They are slackers.
So Joe offered to be here, but...
He did.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then Creighton, he's just, you know,
Creighton's
lifting and tanning and, you know...
Laundrying.
He's off raising money for the Republican Party.
He's off GTLing in Washington, D.C.
So. Actually, you know what I bet he does? He's like a paparazzi for Rand Paul. He just follows him around and takes pictures.
Rand Paul, what do you think of the proximological, epistemological view of...
Just kidding, buddy. Just kidding.
Oh, boy. Well, there has been a lot of stuff this week. There's really been a lot of news over the last... few weeks.
Yeah, it's overwhelming, man.
I know.
It really is. It really is.
Trying to pick out what we're going to talk about has been tough.
There's nothing positive either. There's nothing like where you can say, hey, liberty won.
No, yeah.
Not even close.
Well, we're libertarians. We're never satisfied. So we actually had that discussion this week amongst ourselves. How do you present an inherently negative message in a positive way? Any ideas, Suzanne?
I did write kind of a little article about this. It is difficult because obviously government is this massive thing in our lives and most of what it does really, really sucks. So that is kind of a negative thing. However, one thing that I've been looking into and thinking a lot about is how libertarianism and like classical liberalism as a philosophy is truly positive because it demonstrates what could be, how the world could run, and this kind of, you know, I don't want to use the word utopian, but utopian way of life, you know.
Well done.
Yeah.
Well done.
I don't want to use it, but I'm going to, because I don't think that it's a bad way of looking at it. So I think one thing that people or libertarians should try to do more is instead of hating and ragging on government and going on like, I hate this tirade, kind of try and do the opposite. Be like, well, if this were to happen, then see how this beautiful outcome, you know. So I think it's just a way of framing whatever issue you're talking about. And there is a way that you could kind of step back from the government hate and look more at the positive. This is what good thing will come out of it. If any of that makes sense to you.
It does. Yeah. It does. I mean, for me, it's the biggest thing about the libertarian position is the issue of trust. That I trust you as long as you respect me. And that's got to be the biggest thing because there is no... Just think how great your life would be if there was no government. Because in a debate or any kind of political situation, you just leave the back door open for, why do you hate poor people? Why do you want
right.
babies to die?
Most people can't conceive of a life without government at this point. And I think it's tough for a lot of libertarians to view it that way. I don't know, I would qualify myself as a minarchist, so I'm not an anarchist.
Are you committing?
Yeah, I really am a minarchist, and I think that's essentially what the Constitution is, so
yeah.
That's what I'm going with. So I know that our anarchist friends over here, they're not too down with the minarchists, but let's just all get along.
No. Here's my thought on that. I think minarchism and anarcho-capitalism are the two best philosophies within the whole small L libertarian thing. And I don't appreciate infighting as much as maybe others do. And I feel
Maya.
That...
Yeah.
Maya. I mean, I might swing more full-on anarchist, but I do appreciate and I will support ideas of, you know, the Night Watchman state. I don't think
right.
that it's, And I'm not going to be like, what? You know, we disagree on this tiny, tiny thing. Like,
I'm like, there's
burn them.
Like, that's just so counterproductive. And it's actually really annoys me when people do that.
Maya called me a statist this week.
Yeah, oh, no.
I'm like, really? Okay.
We work with what we have right now. Yeah. And when we take over and we have this beautiful libertarian society, then maybe we can.
When's that coming?
Yeah.
Can I buy tickets?
Just wait. It's, yeah.
That's the truth. I mean, I know that we're probably on this podcast the majority of the time we're guilty of it, but we should talk about what a great society in the world, you know, what will a libertarian society look like and explain what that will look like. And I think we've got a great example, so we'll start with our first topic here. Detroit, the great
perfect libertarian,
the great libertarian city. Look at what libertarianism has done for Detroit. Oh, I'm just kidding.
It's a shining city on a hill.
Yeah, there's MSNBC, you know, Melissa Harris Perry, our favorite, said, you know, see, this is what small government gets you. You get Detroit.
Oh, yeah, that's small government at its finest.
Exactly.
Had nothing to do with Kwame Brown getting about $34 million in kickbacks from his buddy that he gave city contracts to.
Oh, and that's just, I mean, Coleman Young was the mayor of Detroit for like 30 years. The last Republican mayor was 1961. Mm-hmm. There's been one Republican city councilman, I think out of 14, if I remember correctly. But don't quote me on that.
He's probably a Lindsey Graham, too.
Oh, God.
Yeah, so...
It's like a bad word.
Yes.
That's exactly right. That's on this podcast, if you're told that you're acting like a Lindsey Graham, it's the greatest insult that can be besmirched upon you.
Followed closely by John McCain.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So, yeah, there's only been one Republican city councilor, so not known for its libertarian ideals. And I'm sure the Republican that got elected to the city council in Detroit was a small government conservative.
Yeah, he was a Tea Partier for sure.
He was total Tea Partier. Just a few facts about Detroit. This comes mostly from the Census Bureau and from Bloomberg. In 1960, Detroit had the highest per capita income in the United States. Today, it is the poorest large city in the United States. It was once the fourth largest city in the nation, and its population has shrunk from 1.5 million in 1970 to less than 700,000. And the city, the actual square mileage of Detroit, you can fit Manhattan and San Francisco inside of it. It's
wow.
Enormous.
I had no idea.
Yeah, it is huge. There are whole parts of Detroit that just the police cannot cover it.
Yeah, and they're like
at all.
Yeah, they're lawless. Essentially,
they're basically And so there are a lot of people who think that it could be the great libertarian city because the police cannot be police there. Looking at you. Might be where you could go.
Well, I did, not to interrupt your fact sharing here, but I did have a girl who is from Detroit come and talk to one of my classes last semester, and she was trying to encourage students in our class and just basically our age group to essentially go to Detroit and invest, because in the long run, it's gonna pay off.
Right.
Because it's like, you know,
under what
it's,
assumption?
You're getting in on the bottom when it sucks. It's like,
right.
Assuming it will get better, then you can buy cheap and then make profit.
Well, think about it, Greg. If there's whole sections of the city where there's just no law and they can't enforce anything.
All kinds of money.
Right.
But it's never really been law. It's been democratic, single-handed control forever. That's
sure.
Not necessarily
it's
law.
It's regulations and all that. Now, the... I lost my train of thought. Yeah, so what they're doing with a lot of that land that Suzanne is talking about, what is happening is what Suzanne's talking about combined with this land. So they're talking about large-scale urban farming and converting a lot of that farmland down and making it urban farming to feed people, because the problem in Detroit is it can be an hour bus ride to the nearest grocery store. And so the food in Detroit, that's where the term food desert kind of originated. There's just barely any fresh fruit or any quality food, nutritional food in Detroit, because it's expensive and the people there can't afford it. So they're looking at large-scale urban farming and kind of making it a test community.
That's what Dave Bing, their mayor, ran on, and that got blocked.
Yeah. This guy who is the mayor, I've seen a couple documentaries. There's one that's like Detroitopia or something. There's a few interesting documentaries about Detroit on Netflix. And, you know, he has tried to spearhead a lot of, you know, things that are trying. He's trying to fix Detroit. And it is not going well. The residents are not accepting that at all. Like, they did a large study of what neighborhoods were working and what neighborhoods were not working, and said, okay, well, we're going to come in and we're going to pay for you to move to a neighborhood that has growth. This is a neighborhood that there could be growth. Your neighborhood is dead, and there's like five of you living within blocks of each other. You have no food. You have no businesses. There's no reason for you to live here. This should just be abandoned. So we're going to pay you with city money that we really don't have to move to a part of Detroit where you have a chance to get a job and some food and you can walk to a grocery instead of spending hours on the bus getting to a grocery. You know, this is my neighborhood. I'm not leaving. I've lived here since 1973. This is my neighborhood. I mean,
and
it's
that's
like,
what they sound like, too. I've right. heard them.
That's exactly right. It's a dead-on impression. It was this older lady just screaming about how, you know, this is her neighborhood. And he says back to her, and I was like, I started cheering. I was like, wow. He goes, well, you're the reason your neighborhood isn't working then. I was like, damn. Like, I mean, he was very honest. He said, if you're mad that your neighborhood is set to be basically, you know, under this abolished because of this project, it's your fault. You're the reason, you residents of this neighborhood, you're the reason your neighborhood isn't working. That didn't go over well.
No, but it's not like he's going to lose her vote because they don't vote for any other party there.
Right.
You know what I mean? You can pretty much say whatever you want as long as you're running under the ticket of Democrat.
So Detroit's median household income today is $27,000 compared to the state of Michigan's median income of $48,000. So $27,000 a year to $48,000.
Their literacy rate is, what, 48%?
48%.
Yeah.
Detroit's poverty level is 36.2%. The rest of the state, 15%. So more than double. Detroit's unemployment rate is now over 18%, and only 53% of Detroit's residents can be a part of the labor force. 45.7% have no job and are not even looking.
Oh, my God.
So 46.
So bad.
Still want to go invest?
Yeah. How's your buddy? She sounded great now. 35% of Detroit's residents are now on food stamps. The out-of-wedlock birth rate in Detroit is more than 75%. 363,281 housing units are in Detroit, and 99,000 of them are vacant. So,
and that's another point that she was saying, is she was like, go buy property in Detroit because you're going to own all of this property, and one day you're going to, you know, be the landlord for thousands of people
right.
and make so much money. But
I mean, there are a lot of investors that, like, Goldman Sachs experimented with that. The problem was they bought the homes for $1,000 and now they're worth $500.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's like
the average property value was around $4,000.
Yeah.
There.
Like, I mean, they're on pace right now based on their trends of flight out to have a population of zero by 2040. If this maintains itself at zero,
that'd be surreal to have this vacant, vast town.
Ghost city.
That sounds like a great movie. I don't know. A book, maybe.
The Detroit murder rate, 11 times that of New York City.
Wow.
11 times. They have an estimated $14 billion deficit, of which some estimate 80% of that is due to pensions and the benefit packages of government workers.
Yeah, isn't like, what is the statistic? I want to say 1 in 15 people is a government employee.
Five of the 10 top employers in Detroit are government workers. The city has 11,400 workers, and that's the top employer, is the city of Detroit. So you're paying taxes with taxpayer money. So that doesn't really make sense. That's not really revenue neutral. And then that is followed by the Detroit Public Schools at 10,951. So
those aren't considered. Well, yeah, they're still government workers. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not city workers,
the teachers unions. There is a story that I posted on my Facebook that we can tweet out, from Time Magazine. In 2003, there was a Detroit businessman named Robert Thompson, and he offered to give a $200 million donation to a foundation that would then open charter schools, 15 charter schools in Detroit, because he knew the schools were terrible. I mean, the Detroit schools are absolutely atrocious. It was blocked by the teachers' unions.
But so when the teachers can't read, how do you expect them to teach the kids to read?
They just didn't understand the proposal because they couldn't read it. So the proposal was withdrawn, and he withdrew because of the teachers' unions. As far as starting a business, we tweeted out about the entrepreneurial spirit alive and well in Detroit. Your buddy again. According to one survey in Detroit, 56% of small business owners don't even know if they're operating in compliance with Detroit law. The requirements for buildings, mandatory hearings, inspections, code enforcement, just puts 56% of the small business owners outside the realm of compliance with Detroit law.
Are crack dealers included in that or no?
No.
Okay.
They have the highest city property taxes of any big city in the nation, and they have the highest per capita tax burden in Michigan, and property assessments remain overly inflated, amounting to as much as 10 times the market price of the property.
I wonder why people move.
Right.
And why wouldn't you want to live there when you get to pay all those property taxes?
They spend the second most per child,
isn't it,
on their education.
Yeah. They spend almost the San most, and then they have the worst results. Like, these are the dumbest, I'm sorry, children, but you're not that smart for the amount of money that is being spent on them.
I'm just guessing the children of Detroit are not listening.
Yeah, they're
to our
not
podcast.
Listening. No. Thank you. Oh, gosh.
Well, they couldn't be watching the closed caption either on YouTube.
Because they can't read it.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
One of the interesting things, you know, in 1961, Jerome Kavanaugh was elected to... he was one of the first Democratic mayors elected to the mayorship in Detroit. He was a Democrat, and he was the only elected official to serve on President Johnson's Model Cities Task Force. And so he was instrumental in trying to make the Model Cities work for the Johnson administration as part of the Great Society. And they were going off of Soviet innovation. And
the model choice,
right?
Truly. Yes.
And that's why if you've ever been to New York City, you see there are buildings here in Indianapolis off of Mass Ave. Those big buildings that look like Soviet style,
urban planning.
Yeah, right downtown on Mass Ave, and it's surrounded by the Murat and all the hip buildings, and it looks like this just Soviet concrete block sticking out. That's what it was.
It's government housing.
Government housing.
It was an integration plan by some professor somewhere.
Right.
Genius.
So the... I lost my place in what I was reading. So the mayor, Jerome Kavanaugh, pushed through a new income tax and a new commuter tax and promised the poor of the city that the Model City, this 9-square-mile part of the city, would help fund their training, education, health care. They were given cash for training, education, and health care. And they were doling out housing, so the government was planning where people would live, what would be built, what the businesses could be housed there, and when the businesses had to open and close, their hours. So the new income tax and the new commuter tax into the city helped pay for this socialist vision. And the new tax from many of the auto companies like GM and Ford, they basically were taking from the rich to the poor. And that is eventually why they had significant riots throughout the 60s in Detroit. Some of the most dangerous riots. In fact, Kavanaugh was considered like the next Kennedy until the 1964 riots, and his reputation was completely marred. And because the government got involved in central planning in model cities, they took one of the most racially harmonious cities because of the auto industry. Everybody who wanted a job got a job.
Blossoming economy.
Right.
Fixes all ills.
From the 40s to the 60s. And then as soon as they started taking money from one class to give to another class, then there were the class struggles, because one class said, well, we're not getting enough, and the other said, we're giving too much. And that's what created some of the most deadly riots. And that's why in the 70s you got Coleman Young, who was elected to heal all the racial divisions, because
he was the President Obama of the 70s in Detroit. Oh,
the mayor and they had something called the Stress Unit, STRESS unit, and it was responsible for it was like 2% of the Detroit Police Department in the late 60s, and they were responsible for 1/3 of the murders that the police department committed. 2% of the police. And it was for every 1,000 people that lived in Detroit, 7 of them were murdered by the police, by this one unit. In New York City at that time, out of 1,000 people, one person was murdered. 1.8 people were murdered by the police. So it was out of control, and that's what led to the election of Coleman Young, who then served for 30, and I say served with all the irony that I can muster. The city, who doled out massive amounts of corruption to his friends over the next 30 years. And you wanted to be on the city council. Kwame Kilpatrick.
Yep.
The city bought her a brand new $118,000 Lincoln Navigator. $118,000 on the...
She has to have transportation to work.
Right. and it was found out that Kilpatrick had, I think, something like 18 relatives on the payroll in Detroit, and this was like in the late 90s, early 2000s. So he was a peach. So
now in federal prison.
Now, is this how libertarianism works, Suzanne Schaefer?
Well, Chris, thanks for asking. Yes. No, it's not. I think that, okay, you just dumped a lot of information on us, and there's a few key things to pick out of that, which are, I believe, huge factors in destroying the city. And obviously, elected officials, you've talked about, the party of those elected officials, you know, that does play a part. And the pensions, I think, is a big one. You mentioned property taxes, which is also huge. I'm going to throw police in there.
Cop hater.
Well, you know, murder, whatever.
For every dollar that the city of Detroit pays in salaries, they pay out $1.08 additional to retirement funds for civil servants. So every time a government employee in Detroit gets paid, they get paid $2.08 when they are supposed to get paid $1, if that makes sense.
But let's just note, what is the common factor to all of these things? Government is the common factor to all those things. So, I mean, nobody who takes a look at it for, you know, 5 seconds and objectively uses their brain could possibly say that this is, you know, libertarianism's effect on the city, which has made it this way. I mean, even if I was not a libertarian, I would like to believe that I could look at Detroit and say, I'm not going to blame the market on this one, because of everything that you just said. There's just so much proof there. And so you have all this proof. And I think that with that, we can now kind of hypothesize, well, wait a second, how can we fix this? If we know what hasn't worked and what we have tried, what can we try that will work? And I think that that's, you know, Detroit could be a good example of using free market libertarian values to see growth, because I think that, you know, Detroit is not a hopeless lost cause. You can always turn things around, but you have to use the right method. And what is the right method? I'm just going to say, I think that, you know, classical liberal ideas are going to fix this one.
Being on a libertarian podcast, I'd hope you'd say that. Whose hair is that? Well, there's a piece of hair on the board, and it's very long. I think it's my wife's.
Did you shave your legs?
Yeah, that's from my back.
It's my mole hair.
Rick Perry got in trouble this week because he is airing ads in places like California and Michigan and Illinois.
He's poaching.
He's basically
companies.
Saying to companies he's buying radio spots in other states, saying, you know, the environment for business is great in Texas. And he's right. I mean, compare Detroit to Texas and Houston and...
Houston and Detroit are perfect...
Right.
Perfect comparisons. Houston has, like, zero zoning. They have very, very flexible business laws, almost no state tax. I mean, they are a... I mean, as close as you can get to a economic libertarian ideal in the United States, Houston would be it. And they are flourishing. Absolutely flourishing because they don't try to plan anything. They leave things alone. Housing prices, the average home price is like $110,000, and that city's got, what, like $1.8 million?
Mm-hmm. I bet the government doesn't tell their businesses when they can close and open.
They thank them for even being open. I mean, they just by lowering their tax burden. It is Rick Perry should be doing this all over the country like he is and not be shamed for it. He has issues on social, you know. He's not a great social libertarian by any means, but he is a fantastic representative of what leaving alone the economy can do for a state.
And I think that this is just a really good opportunity to show kind of the vision of libertarianism. And this is kind of what we were talking about at the beginning of the podcast, is kind of stepping away from that negativity that often comes with the libertarian profile. And I think that, for instance, in Detroit, the way that it got to be how it is partly through politicians or whoever preaching a vision that they have, you know, that they got people to believe in. Like, if we do this and this and we do these programs and I tax you this much and whatever, we can achieve something. And that's how you get things through government, is you inspire people. However, they're inspiring people kind of in the wrong way. Like, socialism is extremely inspiring if you deliver it correctly. And we can see that from, you know, the past. There's plenty of examples. So we need to do that, but for classical liberalism. Like, we need to help people have the vision that they kind of lack, because, as Chris said earlier, it's really hard for people to picture limited government at this point, because none of them... I mean, nobody alive today has ever really lived with limited government, honestly. So I understand how it could be difficult for people to fathom, like, you know, who will build the roads? Well, you know,
private
for people that do,
yeah,
people that do understand, we need to, instead of being like, well, rah, 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 government, blah, 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 we need to be, you know, preaching, in a sense, the vision of libertarianism and how, like, so instead of wah, Detroit government ruined you, let's step in and be like, look what we can do, and we can help you, and we, you know, and that's positive, and that will get people on your side instead of pointing fingers, I think.
Yeah, once you compare, I mean, the argument is over in my view. You look at what Detroit and an increasing amount of what Detroit did as they increased their efforts by doing the same thing, just maybe in different ways and different phrasing. It led to bankruptcy, and it's what we're doing on the federal level and in most of our states and in most of our cities. When you look at what Houston is doing and Austin, I went in 2011 down to Austin for a libertarian leadership conference, and the cab driver said, no, it's great here. Anybody who wants a job can get a job. Unemployment is like 2-3%. It's fantastic here. Everybody who wants to work can work. And, you know, it's a superior... There's a great way to illustrate this is go to Reason TV and look up the Drew Carey Project, where they compared Houston, Texas to Cleveland, where Drew Carey is from. And they did a series of 4 or 5 videos explaining a free market approach to building your city versus the old way of thinking. Now, Cleveland has tried to streamline things a little bit, and that's why you see in Cleveland... Cleveland's not going bankrupt like Detroit. Mm-mm. You know, Cleveland had the same global pressures, and so did most of northern Indiana where we're at.
Indianapolis,
Elkhart, all had the same global pressures that Detroit had, but Detroit ended up where they were at because they just did more and didn't listen to the canary in the coal mine.
If we just did more of what we did to get here and it had a bigger scale, it'll all turn around.
Right.
It's moronic. It always... The problem is, though, let's say Detroit goes bankrupt. It ends, and it's almost like a free state type project where enough libertarians move there. The problem is you'll never have more than the underclass that's dependent. So if you try to implement a society where it's a minimal government, the social unrest would be enormous. Absolutely enormous riots. It'd be Greece. That's what's happening there.
But if you live in Detroit and you've... I mean... don't you just deserve to riot at this point? Because leadership is just so bad that don't they kind of deserve it?
No, I know. But I mean, let's say a politician gets elected. He's like, or like Belle Isle, that Belle Isle billionaire project. Right. He wants to buy Belle Isle, turn it into a libertarian haven. If he does that, and then that works, and then the city of Detroit tries to do it, it'll never take off.
Well, I don't think Detroit needs to, you know, crash completely and end, and then all the libertarians rush in and try to create something out of it. I think it needs to stop where it's at right now and turn around and go the other way. And I mean, gradually, I think is going to be better for everybody, a gradual change. And if this is possible, you know, starting with government and then scaling it down instead of crashing the city and then going in and trying to just change everything completely. Is this,
yeah. Well, there's policy agenda you can pursue. You can say, mm-hmm. all right, well, we're going to outsource all services. You know, right now that's something that's under consideration for them. So you can do that, but then you screw the unions. The unions are the most powerful thing in Detroit. It is literally an unworkable situation where it has to collapse.
The unions will be irrelevant very soon because there is no business in, I mean,
the federal government will bail out Detroit.
I don't know.
With what?
Are you kidding me?
You're right, Greg. You're right.
You really don't think I'm right?
Or no.
Absolutely. The government loves to bail out things.
I know.
It's probably super excited. Oh my God, I can't wait to bail out this country.
So what is the plan? Here's what the plan for Detroit is, according to the city fathers. Here's the plan. State approves up to $450 million in bonds for Detroit Red Wings Arena and Entertainment District. So the Michigan Strategic Fund Board approved a couple days ago issuing up to $450 million in bonds to finance the construction of a $650 million project that will include a new arena for the Detroit Red Wings and an entertainment district surrounding it. This is very much what we have here in Indianapolis. So you have a city that nobody wants to go to called Indianapolis in the 70s. And so the city fathers all get together and they say, what can save Indianapolis? So
nothing.
We'll no longer be like, I hate this town. I'm getting ready to leave. And so what will save us? What will put us on the map and make us no longer Naptown or Indian O Place? It's not a thriving business economy. It's pro sports. And so what is going on in Detroit is what's gone on in Indianapolis forever. They're going to raise taxes to promote and, build
amateur athletics.
Here in Indianapolis, it was amateur athletics with the Pan Am Games. That led to the Colts coming here. They built a stadium called the Hoosier Dome here in Indianapolis for a pro team in hopes of luring the Baltimore Colts to Indianapolis in the early 80s. They succeeded as Peyton Manning, or as we call him in Indiana, the football Jesus, proved. And then, you know, you had the Pacers, you've got the Indianapolis Indians, you've got the NCAA is located here. You know, this is a town that is not known for sports globally, but it is a very much my cousin who's from California and Boston said, you know what you do in Indianapolis? You know why everybody is fat here in Indiana? Is because the thing that you all do is go someplace and sit down. You know, in other places you go and climb mountains. Here in Indianapolis, you're spectators.
We don't have mountains to climb. It's a problem.
We have hills or something.
Corn. I don't know.
Harvest
but
corn. So we invested a lot of money. Not in, growth.
Yeah, but I mean, we did a good job investing in our universities, and that's what's ultimately led to the resurgence. I mean, so I can't be so hard on them that, if you want to be a major player, and we got the Super Bowl. That never happens if we don't get the Colts.
Right.
You know, there are times when those types of things, as long as they're city-driven and, citizen-driven, I think it's beneficial.
But we didn't make money on the Super Bowl. Neither did Detroit. Detroit, it was such a great way for
the local businesses.
Kwame Kinpatrick. No, not all of them. I mean, there was one local business. There was a local restaurant that was within walking distance of the Stadium Village. It was on the way from one of the big parking structures. And they said, the Super Bowl committee came around and they said, do you want to be part of the Super Bowl map? So people can look at you in the guide and say, oh, let's go eat there. It was a brand new restaurant. And they said, we're not really sure. I don't know. Because they said, if you want to be on the map, you've got to have this level of food. You've got to have these hours. You've got to have this much staff. Gee, It seems like we talked about this similar philosophy in an earlier in the podcast.
But this is a private entity.
Right. And so they said, no, nah, I don't think we can do it. And they said, you're going to be on the map. Okay, I guess we'll be on it. And they were pressured by the city and by the Super Bowl committee to be on the map. So they stocked up like triple what they normally would on food and hours, and not a single person came into their store. Not a single person came in to eat. They lost all the food, lost all that money on staffing, and they closed 4 months later. And they went bankrupt. And that is not talked about in the Indianapolis Star, because that doesn't serve the agenda that we're you know, oh, this is a wonderful event for, and it was fun. But is it worth someone, you know,
one little restaurant going out of business? Restaurants go out of business every freaking day, though, you know?
Yeah, but they were pressured to join is part of it.
I mean,
well,
I'm sure that the one pressure, that one instance isn't what ultimately led to them going bankrupt.
But
there were
other
factors.
That was
but
a very
yes.
common refrain, that businesses didn't see the payoff that they thought they were going to see.
No doubt. It's overestimated the impact. But I mean, that's one of those things where as long as it's the Super Bowl committee, I don't really have a problem with it. It's one private entity and mm-hmm. another private entity.
I mean,
don't
the,
do it,
the Super Bowl
out.
Was in Detroit, and look how much it helped them.
And that's a short-term way right. of helping things, like bringing the Super Bowl for, you know, one day. Is it one day?
I mean, there's yeah. no way.
It was like a week.
Oh,
she's not even an American.
She's such a libertarian.
Oh, my gosh. I don't know.
She's a true anarchist. She's like, Super Bowl, is that where they that like, was, put the orange
that's
ball?
That's the football one, right?
Right, yeah, yeah. Where they get on the court. And
that was
they,
a very Canadian response.
Right.
Oh. I'm sorry.
So, and the Super Bowl in Detroit was a great way for Kwame Kilpatrick to rip off more money. So this is going to be the salvation. It is going to, instead of a $450 million bond to fix the schools in Detroit, they're going to build a brand new hockey stadium.
No, yeah, that's very stupid.
You know what I'm saying?
That's, yeah, it's the idea of like Mount Rushmore. Well, if we build this monstrosity, everyone will come drive and see it, and then right. we'll build monstrosity hotels. And
You know, throwing globs of money that you don't actually have at projects and things, trying to fix whatever, you know, it never works. It really doesn't. And you have to start looking at behavior and what's actually going on beneath the surface. And you need to start thinking, you know, about economics in terms of how people actually behave, you know. And that's, I think that's like the most important thing to the science is take that. I just really want to talk about taxes for a second, because taxes are huge incentives to do or not do something, you know? So if you don't want everybody to move away from your city, then don't have the highest property taxes in the country, you know?
Right.
And it's little things like that that are going to make the differences in the long term, whether that brings about change in a slow manner or a fast one. But if you want people to live in your city, you start by saying, well, what can we do that will make it be remotely possible for them to live here? And taxing them further is never, ever the solution. Like, that's not even up for debate. We all know that.
When 45% of the people in your city can't go to work because they just have stopped looking for a job, and 53% mm-hmm. of them are ineligible of working for whatever various amount of reasons, disability.
Yeah.
And, I mean,
and job skills.
Yeah.
That's what happens is when you're unemployed that long, you have no marketable skills
right.
anymore. You'd be crazy to move a business there.
So, gee, let's see. What becomes the only dependable economy for people who need to feed their kids, who need to feed themselves, who need to pay for shelter, who need to pay for clothes? What is the only economic alternative for them in a situation like that? What would you say that is, Suzanne?
Well, you know what? I think moving away would be a good choice.
What would
personally.
What would be the other alternative if you can't move away, Greg?
Go work for the city government or get on the city council.
Oh, no.
Now, what has happened in Detroit? People work for the government or they don't live there at all.
Yeah.
So that's looking at behavior.
Or
let's keep doing that.
They sell drugs. And then what you get is a cycle.
Is that different than city government?
Yeah. And so there is, I was watching another documentary on the documentary channel, because that's all I do is watch documentaries apparently. And they showed this, they said that every year, you're going to love this, Suzanne. Every year, the amount of settlements that the city had to settle for police abuse cases was equal for several years running to the amount of the yearly deficit, but budget deficit. So if you didn't have so many police because you had to enforce so many nonviolent crimes, gee, you'd think that they would be broke? Or what if they didn't have to pay $20,000 a year for all the people in local and county and state prisons and jails? What if we... you want to talk about global pressure. The war on drugs played a part in the collapse of Detroit. It's not just the unions. It's not just the
terrible education
NAFTA
system.
It's not just government corruption, because every city has corruption. Every city has fought that, you know, and none of those are lethal. None of those things kill any. Nobody dies from corruption, but people die from drugs. People turn to drugs because it's illegal. We've overinflated the price. We've created markets for it. And now we're in an area where it is the only economic alternative for people who live in the middle of Detroit. I mean, it seems to me that this isn't something that was a cause and is not really talked about.
Yeah, I mean, the whole drug war, libertarians understand, is ridiculous, because on the one hand, when we say drug war, that doesn't automatically mean, you know, meth, heroin, like really hardcore drugs. I mean, the majority of it is marijuana, probably, you know, in any kind of, you know, drug instance. And the people that are being put away, the jail systems that are just crowded full of criminals, like, ultimately, I'm sure most of those people either aren't criminals by, you know, victimless crime standards, or they are kind of guided into that life, which is what you're talking about a little bit, when this is like the only other economic, you know, thing you can do that is semi-lucrative for them. And I just think that with the whole police thing, so many of the articles that I read all the time is, oh, we were looking for pot. We were looking for this. We were looking for that. It's drugs. You know, it's not, oh, they were suspected of murder. You know, it always comes back to drugs. So that's the police activities, basically, you know, DEA type. And am I allowed to do that?
No, but that's
okay. And we talk about this 100 times, but end the drug war. You're going to see so many problems get better. And I don't think it's, you know, people like to make it an issue of morals. Like, well, you shouldn't do drugs, blah, blah, blah. But
it's completely a moral issue. It's immoral for you to take a kid who's 14, who, well, 11, let's be honest, 10 to 12, who is in the middle of Detroit, and his only alternative to help with is to help with the family business, get boosted up into a house, unlock the door. And I spent some time today with Rupert Bonham, who runs Rupert's Kids, and he takes kids out of the prison system. And we were talking about why his kids get into trouble, that he mentors, and he brings them out of the prison system and puts them to work. And he doesn't take government money to do it. You know, he mentors them, and he's the first person in their life that they have that is a role model, because every 15 years there's another generation. You know, my grandpa fought in World War II. Someone who is in the bottom 15% of our economic class, and it's not about race. All this race bullcrap is just an agenda that makes people money. It's about economics. It's about economic classes, and the bottom 15% lives off of the drug trade, because that is the only viable alternative because of so many different reasons. I'm not saying that that is excusable. I'm saying that that is just the choice that most of them make. You know, it's should they get a job at the local store? Yeah, probably. But when you're 14 and you need to make money and the nearest business is an hour away by bus, it's easier just to sell crack. Or it's easier just to sell meth, or it's easier to sell heroin, you know? And it's easy because we've prohibited it and overinflated the price. We have stupid, stupid policies that don't help fix our problems. I mean, am I wrong, Greg?
I 100%
Hold on.
Agree.
Yeah. Hold on, Greg. Say that again.
I 100% agree.
Okay, I wanted to get that on tape.
Yeah. I mean, I think there is a slight issue of morality to consider when that kid is in that situation because his parent uses drugs. But the right situation isn't to say no one can use drugs. That'll just perpetuate the problem.
You know, Rupert said that most of his kids, the reason they get in trouble for the first time, like 50% of it is drugs, mostly marijuana. Another 10 to 20% of the reasons that they get in trouble is heroin or meth, dealing heroin or meth. And then, like, the other 30% is just they were bored.
Yep.
And so they were truant, they were, you know, they just were bored, and they were screwing around, and they got in trouble. And so they go to juvenile detention facility, or they go to the jail if they're over 18, and they spend 6 months with professional criminals who then teach them how to become better criminals. Then they get out, and they have ridiculously high parole payments. They can't get a job, so they don't want to go back to jail because that's bad for them. So they steal stuff because yep. that's the only way they can make money. It becomes a perpetual cycle. How is it not immoral that we are putting people away and creating a permanent underclass that we try to blame so many of our society's problems on drugs and on, you know, drug users and criminals, you know, when really there's a way to fix it, and we don't fix it because we want to seem tough on crime? That, to me, is immoral.
Yeah, it's a vanity thing.
Right.
It's completely a vanity thing. But it's one of those things, though, that trade, you have to look at probably what started it. When did marijuana become a huge downfall to, you know, different socioeconomic populations in the United States? And it's, you know, every time. It's when there's an economic depression, mm-hmm. recession, that's what they turn to. And then it becomes sort of a spiral within certain communities where they have no hope out.
Yeah.
So as long as you can fix the economics long term, that's going to be a solution. In the short run, I don't know what you do because there isn't a good answer.
Right.
But we're at a point now where we had talked about having like a bigger trend on this show, a bigger theme. And I'm thinking about, I was like, why is it that the human condition seems to be one for the majority of towards collectivism and then towards moral relativism and then... I mean, we scare easily now, Americans mm-hmm. as a whole. We get spooked. Like, we were going to talk a little bit about Amash, the NSA. That came about because we got scared as a society. Then, things like drug use. I'm not saying it's a moral or immoral issue, but we didn't have that, like, virtuous, purposeful, driven, as a Rand fan, that egoist virtue of selfishness. Like, we've lost that somewhere. And then on top of that, we've become much more collective than we ever have. And I don't know if that starts in the education system or if that starts...
Yeah, yes.
Or is that just humanity?
No. Well, obviously, I feel like I have an opinion here.
That's why we invited you.
I mean, it's an interesting thing to bring up, but I think that a lot of people mistake, you know, individualism and, like, selfishness. They take it for face value and they don't think of it how we mean it to mean, you know, the Ayn Rand sense of the word selfishness.
Yeah.
It's not like I'm going to...
It's purposeful self-interest.
Yeah, it's not like you are, you know, some kid fell down and scraped his knee and he's crying and you just walk by and laugh like, haha, like, you know...
How did you know what I
spent my screw collectivism. Like, you know, it's... I think, you know... Okay, I'm going to use the, you know, human nature, which some, you know, is controversial for some people. But I do think that it is in, you know, our nature to be social, you know, and obviously, like, be around people and things like that. But it is also human nature to look out for yourself, you know, and want to, you know, make the most out of what you have in your life, you know, your utility, all of those things. So I think that the best way to maximize both of those things that are both inherent to human nature is something like, you know, not mandating only one, which is the collectivist part, and not mandating only the other. Nobody does that ever. But, you know, finding a way that the two can kind of work in balance with each other. And of course, what do I think that is? I think that's classical liberalism and all of that. But I don't think that it's one or the other. I think that it's both. Like, I think that you can be an individual and work in a community at the same time. You know, I don't think we only go one way or the other.
But I feel like there's no break on that. Because, like, I feel like the United States was founded on individualism. That was, you know, one of the mm-hmm. most independent political revolutions ever. And I think that's why, like, you see Texas. I think that's why they've been the way they've been, is there's that certain Texas, I guess, mm-hmm. belief, you know, everything's bigger and better in Texas.
We're special.
We know more than you, you know. So we're
Texas
gonna do
exceptionalism.
Texas exception. No, really. I mean, that's, and I think that plays a huge role in the way they've developed. We're in the United States. We had that originally, but over time, I feel like everything trends towards collectivism. Texas will experience it eventually. Everywhere does. I don't see anywhere where I can say specifically independence is the standard.
Human beings have a need to be part of communities and part of belongings, part of a pair. You know, it's weird if you're 40 years old and you've never been married.
Yeah.
You know, like it's, we are.
Well, for a girl, for a guy, it's great.
Right. For, but even for, you know, I have like 40 year old guy friends. I'm like, they're not married. Are you okay? Like, it's not like a, you know, that thing. It's like, just,
I wish that was on camera.
Yeah. It's like, are you mentally damaged or like, but like people think that way, you know, it's, we're a social animal. And really it comes down to force, is someone being forced to do something to against their will, and government inherently is force.
And people, like, people want to be part of a team, you know, people want to be accepted and
except
all of
for
that.
Maya.
But you don't, people don't want to be forced to be on a team, like you have to do this, you know, and that is the fundamental difference, is the force of it. Like, nobody's saying, you know, when we're talking about a free society, nobody's saying every man for himself. You know, we understand and we expect and we want that people work together and come together and, you know, compete with each other. And, you know, you can say, oh, my city's better than yours, whatever. But the difference is you can't put, you know, a blanket across all of that and give them all the same rules to live by, all the same measurements, all the same regulations, blah, 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 force people. I mean, and that's what it comes down to. And people often mistake that idea of collectivism as, you know, versus individualism as I hate you and leave me alone and we're not going to work together. And it's at all.
I feel like even voluntary communal association is a slippery slope. I feel like, and that's one of my big deals with the anarchist position, is how do you know that the collectivists won't organize?
But they will. They will
exactly.
organize.
And they will. They will fight you.
But
they. I promise you, if we ever get to a position of just pure anarchy, people will organize. Then they will go to conquer. That is the story of human history.
Final that's, point.
I think that people, yes, they will organize.
Why will libertarian not be Somalia? That's inherently what you're saying.
And like, I mean, that's why I don't necessarily embrace, like, I really am a big proponent of like a constitutional republic where you have a explicit set of rights that is a stopgap against collectivization.
All right, we're going to give the final nerd point over to Suzanne the anarchist, and then we're going to move on to Amash. Why?
Okay, I just want to point out that it's not like there isn't violence taking over right now. Like, we have a government, we have a constitution, we are going to other countries, you know what I mean? So I don't think that to say that having government is going to prevent violence in that way, because we have a government and there is violence in that way. So
I'm not saying it's government. I'm saying a contract that everyone has to abide by that is a stopgap against force.
But we have that and it's not working.
Boom.
No, right, I agree.
All right.
I agree. So I'm trying to say, how do you ever stop that?
We could argue minarchist versus anarchist all day long, but
well, that's anarchist theory.
What about a libertarian dictator?
A libertarian dictator. I will take over and rule so I can leave you alone.
Exactly. See, now that's the ideal solution.
I mean, if we could have... Okay, this is the last point. Okay. If we could have, you know, a kind of constitution or something that represents all of these things that doesn't expand, then that is my issue. And that's what keeps me between minarchism and anarcho-capitalism, is we started out very, very small and it has gotten bigger. And it's like, I kind of, because government, it's not, you know, an inanimate object. What, it's not a building, it's people, and people are predictable. And so I view government as this kind of living organism, and it's going to want to expand itself.
All you have to do is,
because that's what it does.
Article 10 grants all a power to the states if you take out that last clause.
All right.
Okay.
Nerd fight over.
I'm saying.
Oh, Creighton is going to be so mad.
I know, right?
Creighton misses one episode, and we get to into the praxeological of the exam and a
little bit of hoppa porn.
Yeah. No, Creighton is like, Creighton loves.
What is he?
He says he's an anarcho-capitalist, but Maya disagrees with that.
Yeah, I think now he's identifying as like a true original conservative, like a Jack Hunter.
Right.
Sorry. That was great. Creighton, I support you.
That was on tape, Suzanne.
I don't infight.
Yeah. Yeah, right?
I don't nitpick philosophies as long as we're all under the libertarian family.
That's right.
Okay.
Pot, kettle, black.
All right. So Justin Amash. Let's move on to Amash Engorgement. We have Rand Boner, and now we have Amash Engorgement. Sorry about that.
It's okay.
By the way, we should have warned her that we have
sexual innuendos
for the excitement of libertarians over Rand Paul and Justin Amash.
That's okay with me.
All right.
I'm okay with it.
So.
Oh, she's a true believer in Ron Paul.
Oh, she'll see Ron Paul and a picture of Ron Paul taking the quiz in my office, and she's like,
he's so hot.
He's so adorable.
That is not at all what I say. However, I did
you totally odd.
I was trying to find pictures of him for the website, and I came across a picture of him when he was really young, and he is so cute. And you're right. I get this kind of like, oh, Ron. I don't know. I just think he's the greatest thing that has happened, or one of the best things that has happened for libertarianism in a long time.
It's her.
And
Clinton.
I'm just very thankful. I'm thankful to you. Also, never mind. I have to go.
Okay. Yeah, Rand.
Vegan soy latte run.
Yeah. So Justin Amash created a little bit of news this week. Would you like to tackle this since I tackled Detroit? What did Justin Amash do this week, Greg Lenz?
Justin Amash decided to add an amendment to the Department of Defense funding bill. And what it did was it banned any appropriations going towards the use of the NSA's collection of all of our records. It was actually a one-page amendment. It's very simple, very easy to read. It was the way I wish Washington worked all the time.
Now, how did what was that, Suzanne?
One page, you say? That's a good. That's a good sign. That's a really good sign.
They said, "Ha ha, you joker."
We require at least 1,000 pages.
Yes.
Fun fact: before I move on to my next point, Justin Amash has a cousin that works for The Blaze, Glenn Beck's network, and his name is Justin Amash.
You're kidding.
I'm not kidding, yeah.
There are two Justin Amashes.
Yeah, because I went and listened to the Glenn Beck interview with Justin Amash, and they mentioned that. So that's kind of weird. It didn't get a lot of press, and we talked about this in this week's show report. If you go to wal-radio.com, you can get the show report where we critique the media. So we wrap up the week's media and help you think differently about the media you consume and commercial. And we talked about how it didn't get a lot of press, but that was, Amash didn't want it to get a lot of press. And I thought it was kind of interesting that he didn't go to any of his media contacts. He just kind of pushed it on his social media networks at the beginning because he wanted to be able to craft his talking points in secret and not tip his hand. Which, to you, Justin, if you're listening, I say, you're trying to defund a spy agency. I'm sure they knew. But do you think that was a wise move, Greg Lenz, that he didn't want to really kind of rattle the apparatus at all?
I don't know that it was rattle the apparatus. Like, I thought it was a really strategic, smart move, personally. I would have done it the exact same way because it gave him time to spring it, but it didn't give Boehner... Boehner let him vote on it. So, I mean, I got to give props to Boehner, even though he disagreed with it. But, like, Eric Cantor would have gone on the Sunday shows and talked about, they'd have branded him as, like, a liberal, a Republican liberal. And then the Democrats, the ones like like a Chuck Schumer type, would have gone on there and, brandished him as someone that hates America, a Snowden fanboy. And I thought it was just really smart.
Or let's say something crazy like a New Jersey governor comes out and says, you're going to have to sit across from 9/11 widows.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a purely emotional argument, but that never happened.
No, I mean, Chris Christie's kind of an idiot. He's not even really a Republican, but that's besides the point. I just feel like I thought it was the best way to go about it. He's kind of an inconsequential House member. I mean, outside of the libertarian movement, no one really knows who he is. Huffington Post covered it, Politico, Drudge. I mean, it got news. It got political news coverage, maybe not national. And I wouldn't have done any different.
I have a friend who's in Congress, and I asked him about Amash, and he said, well, he's not really liked by his own delegation at all because he doesn't vote with the delegation. He doesn't cooperate with the delegation. And
he's transparent.
He's just not a team player. And I said, that's awesome. And he looked at me and he goes, really? I'm like, yeah, You should be that way.
Yeah. People might talk about you.
So, Suzanne, what did you think about the whole Amash Amendment and what it encompassed, not necessarily what the vote was?
My first thought was kind of how, I mean, of course, I have a hard time understanding how you disagree with what he's doing, you know, and I just don't see how it's un-American or anything like that. I mean, the whole Edward Snowden thing, if you think that Edward Snowden was a traitor to this country, like, I just can't even talk
just
to you.
Just go ahead and say it. Please kill yourself now.
No. I don't advocate
voluntarily
that,
kill yourself,
but
now.
Voluntarily,
yeah,
you know, because what he did was absolutely American, you know, and the administration is supposed to be transparent. The most transparent administration in history is supposed to be transparent, like, and he was helping make it transparent. You know, we as citizens, we don't have to be transparent. The government does, and that's the issue here, is they're flipping that. They say, you as a citizen, if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear, we should be able to know everything about you because it should all be good. But we, on the other hand, we harbor all the secrets, and, you know, we don't have to tell you what we're doing, and that's,
or be
like,
able to search their own emails, like,
yeah,
the NSA.
But that's that's so fundamentally, if you think back to, you know, the founders and all that, that's so fundamentally un-American. And I just think that what he's trying to do is he's trying to rein it in. That's, of course, always what any good politician does, is try to rein in the power. And I just get really frustrated that it got shot down.
When I was growing up, and I don't know if you guys feel this way, Suzanne's a little younger than we are, and she's been a libertarian longer than me. So she's like, she's in
playing with the ideas.
Right.
You know, I wasn't what I am now.
She's around 20 and I'm around 30. But she's been exposed to libertarianism longer than I have. But when I grew up, I really felt like you could trust the government. Like, the government is the thing that you want to have the power, because that's the thing that is made up of the people. And it's safer for the government to have it than maybe a corporation, or certainly not another country. Like, I don't feel that way. And I don't know if it's because I'm become a libertarian and more, you know, on Suzanne's side of the libertarian spectrum every single day. I feel, though, that societally we have completely lost that feeling and that emotion. Like, there has been a complete erosion in trust and faith in our institutions. I mean, am I...
Cynicism is an all-time high.
Yeah.
All-time high.
And, I mean, it's a little harder for me to gauge because a lot of the people in my network are libertarians and they do question the government. But I also do have a lot of, you know, friends and know a lot of people that have that innate trust in government.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, part of it probably depends on, you know, how you were raised and things like that. What did your parents think, of course, but I'd like to think that we're heading that way, because that's a good thing. It's good to question. You always question authority. When you stop questioning authority, they will stop becoming accountable, and then they will do what the government is doing, and they will become corrupt, because government, like I was saying, is inherently corrupt. It's just, that is its nature. Going to be that way.
Yeah, there has to be a check and balance, and we see that in Detroit. There's no check and balance on power in Detroit. It's absolute power if you get elected, because there is no Republican. There's no Republican opposition on the council. There's,
because people,
you know,
trust it to do what it says. And one thing I always love to bring up with whoever I'm talking to, because it's just something that clicks in my mind, is take a look at history. What has history already shown us? You know,
right.
We're not pioneers anymore. Mm-hmm. We know what's happened. We know what is going to happen, but apparently we don't. I don't know. But if we just read a history book, like, government has never, I mean, what is one instance where they actually came in and saved the day and we all cheered? Like,
well, I was watching the History Channel, and there was the time that Gorthrop the alien came in and saved the Union from the devil, Jefferson Davis. That was a good episode of
Gorthrop the alien.
Oh, I just made that up.
But it's only ever proven time and time again the government was doing something wrong. You know, from Watergate to now, from the Romans to now, from everything ever, government has always been doing something wrong behind your back and not telling you about it. You know, whether that's murdering you or spying on you or whatever, that's what's been happening. So I don't know why people think we're immune to that now because we're America. And
the notion that because like someone tried to justify the NSA because there are like 20 people that have access to the data and the program. I'm like, that's worse. That doesn't make it better. That makes it more secretive. That makes it worse.
The justification of that, though, was when they called that emergency meeting at the head of the NSA in Congress, and they said they stopped 54 terrorist attacks and presented the evidence for it.
Right.
So, I mean, that's a pretty compelling argument to an average American citizen. I run into it a lot with friends that aren't political at all, and they say, I've got nothing to hide. I want to know that the terrorists are going to kill us.
You do have something to hide. You do have information that you don't want out there.
Well, now they can get your passwords.
Let's say you're a congressperson and you're tweeting pictures of your wiener. You want to hide that. But we'll talk about that in a minute. The reaction to the Amash Amendment, you know, here in Indiana, in our delegation, only super liberal Andre Carson, he's a progressive, he voted with Justin Amash.
Rokita abstained.
And then the other Congress folks voted for it. Jackie Walorski got grilled by Casey Hendrickson on his show yesterday, and he put a podcast up. We talked to Casey in the show report. And Michelle Bachmann came out, and I'll put this in the show notes. Michelle Bachmann's justification that, you know, we've got to stop this false narrative, which that's when I started laughing. We've got to stop this false narrative that we're listening to your phone calls. That's just not happening.
That's beside the point.
You're
like
saving them
out.
So you can listen to them later.
And it's completely untrue. What is the giant NSA facility in Salt Lake City built for? It is to store every email, every Facebook post, every phone call that you've ever made.
But I would just like to point out, people go down that trail, and that is completely irrelevant whether or not they're actually listening to them. It's the fact that they can if they want to.
Sarnoff, afterwards, they had phone calls between him and his wife. And it was leaked on CNN by one of the FBI experts. He's like, I really shouldn't have said that. I know. I'm glad I don't have a car that can be hacked. So, I mean, it's...
But see, that's a tough one to use, because then that is a good justification for having that kind of program.
Right.
They were able to access his phone calls, and, you know, they have a solid case against him.
Yeah. I mean, let's just... any final thoughts on the Amash Amendment before we move on to... So, we've talked about the erosion of our cities and economics. We've talked about the erosion of our institutions, and then next we'll talk about the erosion of our culture. So every episode, there's a little bit of a theme that you may not be able to pick up on, but we kind of craft a little theme into every show with the topics.
This one's called We're Damned.
That's usually the overarching theme of the entire show, but this episode is just erosion. Any final thoughts on Amash and the amendment and the NSA deal?
The NSA can suck it. I appreciate Amash, and we're all frogs in hot water, except for me and libertarians.
Yeah.
The end.
Well, at work this week, Suzanne completed her internship with me at my work. We work with the Advocates for Self-Government, and my boss is a Republican. And there was something with the NSA, and you're like, oh, gee, what if there had been a group of people who would have warned you? And he just walked out and shut the door. because it's just been so nice having a couple libertarians running around this office to help bash Republicans.
That's what's funny is I feel like libertarians have more in common with the Republicans, but they bash the GOP more than they do Democrats.
I totally bash Democrats way more. I'll throw that out there.
I hate Democrats.
I
still don't trust Ripley.
When you talk about the whole lesser of two evils thing, I think Republicans are the lesser of two evils.
I don't. I think that the Republicans are worse because they're liars.
Okay, liberals are liars too.
Democrats tell you exactly what they're going to do. They're just wrong. Republicans do the exact same thing the Democrats do. They just tell you they're going to be for our values.
What were we just talking about? The NSA and all the secrets they're keeping and not telling us what they're doing.
What party is he in?
The Republican Party.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Which guy? What are you talking about?
Amash.
Oh,
Amash.
Oh, yeah.
Rand Paul, what party was he in?
We got two.
Hey, it's a start.
Republican.
Ron Paul, what party is he in? Hey. Bob Barr?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where are the Democrat Ron Pauls? Oh, uh-huh. Wait. They don't exist. Uh-huh.
Dennis Kucinich was...
Oh, my God. He's a socialist. He is a direct descendant of Karl Marx.
It depends on what issue you're talking about. He's not a descendant. When you're talking about privacy issues...
Economics?
Russ Feingold?
The foundation of everything, and that's where every discussion should start and stem from?
See, I don't think that economics is the foundation of absolutely everything.
Oh my god,
stop. Next
worst
topic.
Libertarian ever.
You need to read some.
I mean,
economics is
the foundation of everything.
All right, I want to get to wieners.
It's the science of behavior, human behavior, and that is you and I and everybody else and everybody that has created everything.
Creighton, can you take off your wig now, please?
Okay. Let's just change the subject.
Back to the important subject.
I don't like infighting.
Some wiener. I want to talk about
just
wiener.
Kidding. This is ridiculous.
I don't necessarily want to talk about wiener. Although, who gives a...
Sorry. Again? I don't know why I do that. I don't know.
Oh, trust me, you're nothing compared to Gina.
All right. Yeah. But who truly cares? Because I don't. Next.
I think that...
His last name is funny.
I don't want to talk about Wiener. I want to talk about this girl, Sydney Leathers. And what a nut job this girl is.
Indiana native.
Yeah. Look her here. Look her up on your computer. Sydney Leathers.
Okay.
Indiana native. You know... Lying here, I'm going to turn off your mic here for a second. You can laugh all you want.
I will.
So Sydney Leathers texts or Facebook.
Certainly blogging about this later.
Ma'am, I'm blogging about this later. I'm going to give you a stern dissertation on economics, and you're going to
write you a strongly worded essay.
Right. You will feel my wrath. So Sydney Leathers is this girl who is this groupie. She dropped out of high school in 11th grade. She is obsessed with becoming famous. That's all she wanted to do was become famous. She's this 24-year-old girl.
Yeah, 23, 24.
Who messages Wiener, you know, I support you, stand strong, you're the man. Now she's coming out on a TV. He's just not the man I thought he was. It's like, you messaged him and started talking to him because he sent pictures of his Wiener. And now you're mad because he sent other girls pictures of his Wiener. That's exactly who you thought he was. But I find it to be a disturbing trend that this girl is... I mean, when you look at her psychology, she is not interested in issues. You know, the blogging that she does is just sort of superficial, and I hate Republicans, and Mike Pence can go die, and, you know, she's one of the guys that should hang out. Yeah. She's one of these contributors to this Indiana Progressives Facebook page that just puts out absolute nonsense. Listen, I don't like Republicans, but you can bash Republicans and not be stupid at the same time. And she's just very superficial. And I see a lot of this in politics today. You know, Wiener and his complete psychosis and pathology and the fact that he wants to run one of the world's largest economies while being a complete lying dirtbag, I'm used to that at this point. What I find interesting is that this girl, her path to fame, her path to a VH1 reality TV show is now politics. I mean, is that an interesting sign in American culture that we now see politics as some way? It's not public service anymore. It's a way to get yourself on a reality TV show.
I don't think so. I mean, politics is the original drama in theater. I mean, it is always, it's, you know, DC is Hollywood for ugly people. It's always been that theatrical element of it, so why not
showcase it? I don't think it's really
showcase
always
it.
Been that way.
Oh, absolutely. The Federalist Papers were nothing but showing off. If that was a real discussion, it would have happened in, like, Constitution Hall over the...
That is a good point.
Of showing off was it? It was a showing off of how intellectual you were, not that kind
there,
of showing off.
Yeah.
Like,
there
look
is
at this
a difference.
Selfie of me.
Monica Lewinsky.
Yeah, but that's not
ancient.
Marilyn Monroe.
But that's still you're getting kind of into this age. I mean, that's not that long ago. I think in the grand scheme of things, I would say there's probably a trend towards the whole flashy reality TV type thing. You know, the like, for instance, politicians have to look good now because they're on camera. Nobody wants, you know, an ugly politician. Or looks play a part, whether that's, you know,
For better or worse.
You know, we're always talking about the first lady and what the hell she's wearing, which shouldn't be something that is ever brought up. Ever.
go look at a picture of Anthony Weiner in high school and look at a picture of this girl and tell me that he could have gotten her in high school. mean, he was such a weirdo.
I don't know if anybody's ever read Amusing Ourselves to Death, but I wouldn't agree with everything that Neil Postman says in there, but I do agree that the whole television platform has altered politics.
People your age, you're at IU and you're, you know, in the middle of your college experience and you're politically involved. And I mean, what are the personalities like of kids today who are politically engaged? I mean, are they true believers who are engaged, or is there a superficial level to people involved in politics?
Very roughly, I'm going to outline three types of people, okay? There are your political nerds who read and actually know what they're talking about, or, you know, they find a philosophy and they can advocate it, they whatever, you know? And I know a lot of people like that. I'm more in that category than anybody else. I mean, not anybody else, than any of the other categories.
I am king of the political nerds.
I read all the books.
If you'd like to read my book.
And I always for another storm warning.
I have so much to learn. But then there's the kids who are more of, you almost feel like they're seeing the whole thing as like sports or something. You know, like it's more politics than philosophy. Because they're, I mean, the two go together, but then you can definitely split them up. Sorry, I'm pulling this away.
She's a hand talker.
I'm a hand talker. I hate it. I'm sorry. But yeah, there's the kids that are really interested in watching the news and knowing all the politicians' names, and they will gauge you on names, you know, name dropping, things like that, you know, your congressman, blah, 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 the numbers of it all. And yeah, that is significant in some way, but at the same time, it's not the whole package. And I think a lot of the interest that kids have for that is they want to play the game, because it is a little bit of a game. And then
what's a career for those types? Staffer. Well,
you know what really is annoying is the people who like want to become famous in politics by starting a podcast or starting a blog.
I hate those people. Yeah.
Those people are so annoying. Who's the third type?
The third type is the kid who doesn't care about anything.
Right.
Political.
Right.
But.
And they should die in a fire.
I was that type.
She said it with her eyes.
I didn't say it, but it's important. And when people say it's not important, it doesn't affect them, then they're just demonstrating to me their ignorance, and it's hard for me to take them seriously.
Well, judge much?
No, but she's right.
She's right.
She's right. I mean, you know, and I sometimes excuse it because it's a totally rational reaction to an irrational system, but it just means, I mean, politics, it's life and death at this point. Mm-hmm. I mean, you look at the prison and the drug discussion that we had later, you know, when you talk about economics, well, we should privatize stuff. Well, when you start privatizing services, privatizing assets, I'm all for, but you privatize services, it means you're privatizing lives. So I have a friend whose daughter died because of the private prison system, because they needed to make a profit every quarter for their shareholders. So they can't they can't decrease the salaries that they pay for nurses and doctors, because that makes them less competitive. They can't charge the state more because it's in the budget. And so what do? They just give less services and they cut services. And then people start dying across the country because they're not cared for medically because of privatization. That's life and death. That's a conscious choice not to pay attention.
Or is that a lack of competition?
Let's not forget
But who's allowing that, Greg? It's us allowing that by voting in politicians
who
say, I'm going to privatize the, you know, I mean, we love to hear that stuff. It's our own fault then.
Yeah, but I mean, if you're going to privatize it for real, you know?
Don't forget about the regulations that are the lurking variable here that are causing a lot of these problems, not pure privatization.
Right.
But I think with kids, when it before it actually affects them, you know, they don't see how it's affecting them, or they think, you know, when I get a job and start paying taxes or whatever, then I'll start to think about it. Or they'll think of it in terms of politics. When they think of politics, they think of politicians or just like little things here and there, and like the quarrels and Democrat Republican. But one thing that I was telling you about the thing I was at last weekend. One of the things that was talked about is how we are trying to help save lives. You know, it's not, I mean, yes, there's the nitpicky part of politics and there's the policies and I can see how it can get boring for sure. Like, I understand how not everybody is fascinated by it and not everybody wants to read about it and not everybody wants to make it their entire life. Like, it's exhausting. It is absolutely an exhausting topic, and you can never know everything. Like, there's always more. It's always changing. I'm exhausted just thinking about it right now, you know? But the bottom line is, because it's economics, which is everything, and which is how the world runs, you know, it ultimately is life and death. You know, it's going to affect people's lives, and not just the quality of their life, but whether they have life at all. And it's a lot easier to ignore that in America, because comparatively speaking, there are a lot of things that we don't face, you know, when we walk outside of our door that are faced in other countries. But just because we don't see them every day doesn't mean that other people right now at this very moment don't see those things every day. And that's why it's important, because we're talking about the grand scheme of things. And I mean, when I say we, I'm going to speak for libertarians, at least the ones that I know. You know, we're not just thinking about ourselves, actually, and our immediate situation. We're trying to think of, what do we want to stop? What do we want to help make not that way anymore, outside of our doorstep, in our city, and the whole world? You know, like, I'm involved with, I'm going to plug it a little bit, Students for Liberty. It's awesome. And we're, you know, it's international. Like, we just had the regional conference in West Africa yesterday. There was over 300 people. Like, West Africa is not Fishers. You know, we're not, it's not.
What do you mean?
Really, Suzanne? It's not.
Yeah.
No. But
please articulate the differences between West Africa and Fishers.
Well, no, but
not
it's
so many yoga classes.
Are you telling they don't have a Red Robin there?
I don't believe that they do have Red Robin.
What?
It's ridiculous. We want to bring Red Robin to West Africa. No, but it's, I think what people who don't care, you know, are demonstrating is, I don't know, selfishness in the sense of the word that they actually think that it means, you know, like, it's ignorant, and it's all kinds of bad words. And I'm not saying, you know, it's easy to not understand. Like, I understand that. So I'm not like bashing those people. I'm just, you know, when I talk to those people, and when anybody talks to those people, you kind of just need to be like, hey, well, what about this? You know, like, this is actually happening. And it's actually, you know, it's really sad for a lot of people.
Let's wrap up. Very nice, Suzanne. Because my wife, I'll end. At the end of the show, we always like to give plugs or talk about something that we missed. We have to wrap up quickly because my wife is graduating from beauty school. She graduated on Thursday, so we're about to go to a celebratory party for my wife. So I wanted to say congratulations to her. And if you are in the Indianapolis area and you need your hair did or your nails did, then get in touch with me and I'll put you in touch with her. Greg?
Nope, I'm good.
All right. Suzanne, plug yourself one last time. Where do you blog at? Where will you write?
Oh, stop plugging me.
Write excoriations.
Yeah, what meta subreddit, meta-beta-reddit, are you writing these opinions
in? Not on Reddit.
Anarchy and a cup of coffee.tumblr.com. So,
which I don't actually really put my opinions on.
I know, but lots of good stuff there. So, all right, thanks for joining us here on We Are Libertarians. And as always, next week we promise
to do better next time.
Music for We Are Libertarians is provided by Hoosier musician Brian Keith Wallen. Please check out his website, briankeithwallen.com. The song is Bad Spell.